very much, Mr. Holm, and to your team for Konami. We have your legal submissions, which we've read. We've had pre-circulated evidence, which we've also read. So please tell me how you'd like to proceed.
Well, sir, we're going to keep it as short as possible. Two experts on my left have produced short statements that they will read. Paul and Debbie Brainerd on my right will be very happy to answer any questions, but I've said to them there's no need to read from their evidence as long as you're happy with it.
I am, Mr. and Mrs. Brainerd. You're very welcome. Thank you for your evidence and for your contribution to the Lenape community.
Would we start, sir, with any questions for Paul or Debbie Brainerd based on their evidence?
I don't have questions, I just found it very fascinating.
No, no questions. It was just good to have all that background information. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Good to see you both. Good to see you looking so well.
We didn't expect to be here, but got caught by COVID-19. We should go home to the States at the beginning of April, but obviously we're still here, and we feel very lucky and fortunate to be in this country at this point in time.
America's loss is our gain. The International Living Future Institute.
Yes.
You were the first ecology education project that's been certified by...
In the world, yes.
On the planet. That's quite astounding.
We're very pleased by that. There was a lot of energy and effort that went into that by a whole team of people throughout New Zealand, engineers, community members, the artists, the craft people, because it's a holistic standard, not just the buildings themselves. You know, the creativity, the art, the place, the community elements are all taken into consideration, as well as social equity. So it's generally regarded as the most difficult standard to meet in the world. And we had to operate the buildings and show and demonstrate for a year that we actually could operate them as we had designed them in terms of net positive energy and net positive water. And we not only met, but we exceeded them in terms of our goals. So we're just very happy about that.
Absolutely.
We had a celebratory Zoom call because that was during lockdown. We gathered everyone together on Zoom and had a toast.
That was definitely worth a mention, because the one thing, being Scottish, you live in New Zealand, and New Zealand constantly bats above its station. Mm-hmm. And having little old Glenorchy batting up above its station for New Zealand is, well, I thought it was well worth a mention, so thank you very much.
The one quick thing I would add is one of our intentions was to create this project as an example or inspire people, hopefully, to build sustainability. It didn't need to be stark or sterile. It could be in a place, in a community, in a rural environment. And the public tours we've given, and the fact that people can come and stay there and actually see. So every time someone comes, we challenge them at the end of the tour, for example. What have you learned today that you can take home to your local community, that you can apply in your own home, your own business, and in your community? We've given tours now to over 3,000 people. So Governor General for the ministries, we've had all kinds of different people, and just everyday people, and all of them have taken away, I hope, some inspiration to do this in their local community.
I think they should be inspired.
Mm.
Thank you very much to you both.
No, I think Paul said it all.
Thank you.
So I'll ask Mr. Holgrave to do his economic evidence, sir. We have a statement there in your hand now.
Thank you. the CNFS profile population demography and project its future retail demand. This retail demand is forecast to grow from 52 million in 2018 to 145 million in 2043, an increase of about 93 million to 178%. Next, I acknowledge COVID-19's severe short-term impacts on health, society and the economy, but note that planning for the future must continue, particularly given the long lead times associated with developments. I then performed desktop study of the commercial precinct located on Miles and Argyle Streets. My review characterises it as a mixed-use area dominated by accommodation, tourist services and cafes with very little retail activity. More than 40% of the zoned land is currently vacant and the building stock is generally old. Given the limited retail commercial reach of the commercial area on Mull Street, and noting the 12% limit on building coverage proposed by Poanamu for their site, I consider the proposal unlikely to have any adverse effects on the existing commercial area. I also note that the centre of the existing commercial precinct is only a 5-minute walk from the subject site, so the two areas are most likely to act as one broader commercial offer. This is confirmed by comparing the 5-minute walk to other district centres, particularly Wanaka and Queenstown, which are roughly a 10-minute walk from one side to the other. Next, I'll discuss the proposed exclusion of back-of-house functions from the calculation of GFA thresholds. I show that this would increase the size of enabled retail and office tenancies by about 40%. However, because total GFA is limited to only 12% of site coverage, this just enables future GFA to be configured more flexibly without increasing the total amount enabled. Accordingly, it will have no material effects on other centres, either in Glenorchy, Queenstown, or further afield. I then consider likely economic benefits in developing the Mrs. Woolley site. I note that the process of planning for, designing, constructing and fitting out new buildings will take at least 2 years and draw on workers from a diverse range of fields. Based on the latest indicative costings, I estimate that redevelopment of the site could create full-time work for 80 people for 2 years and create 7.7 million of household incomes. Plus, once operational, the proposal will create significant ongoing employment. Finally, I note that the proposal will improve local self-sufficiency, thereby reducing the need for locals and visitors to travel to Queenstown to meet their day-to-day household needs. This, in turn, will generate significant and enduring economic benefits, including reduced travel costs, fewer accidents, and less congestion in and around the Queenstown town centre. Overall, my evidence shows the proposal will avoid any material adverse effects while enabling a range of important economic benefits. Accordingly, I support the proposal on economic grounds.
Thank you, Mr. Colgrave. But a question arising from your evidence about the shape of commercial development in Glenorchy. We've had other evidence from Mr. Glover, who suggested to us, in support of his and his wife's submission, that the commercial overlay needs to be extended down Mull Street towards the lake to recognise the fact that that's what's actually happening, and the council staff are recommending we accept that submission. Poanamu is suggesting that it be extended the other way to Mrs. Woolley's site and the land behind it. We almost certainly don't have jurisdiction, but Mr. Glover made another point that the commercial overlay had been extended to Islay Street and it had been a failure. Your comment that 40% of the sites are unoccupied would seem to support that. As I say, we don't have jurisdiction to recommend it, but should we be recommending to council that it reconsider the overall size of the commercial overlay in Glenorchy, potentially deleting sites along Islay Street and having, as you say, elongated on the lake end, elongated on Oban Street, and therefore, on the face of it, on a pure economic position, it's going to be far too much commercial. 40% sites unoccupied. We need to delete a few?
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, I haven't looked at that in any detail, but I guess there's potentially some scope for reviewing the likely role and function of the commercial precinct going forward. I don't think there's obviously some useful land uses there and so on, but it's been some time since real development's occurred. There's only been two buildings constructed in the last 20 years, so it seems like the market's saying that there isn't a great appetite for additional development there. I'm not sure if I'd go as far as to say we should roll back some of the zoning. I haven't obviously turned my mind to that. And I'm also aware that there's some potential flood risks in parts of the precinct as well, so I'm not sure how extension towards the lake would play out in that regard either.
And the other question I had is, it goes to your the area of your evidence where you're polishing up your crystal ball about a post-COVID world. I'm looking at figure 4 on page 14.
Yes.
What's the 2020 bar going to look like? That's probably there are a whole series of uncertain things, but that might be at the more certain end of the uncertain things.
Yeah.
How big a hit is it going to be?
I think calendar year 2020 is going to be pretty bad. I mean, I think in terms of international visitors to New Zealand, but I think domestic visitor is the sort of the segment that people will be focusing on for the short to medium term in terms of the opportunity. Certain international visitors are going to take a little while to come back. But I think, you know, we're talking about a long-term project here with a long-term aspiration. We're not talking about something that wants to be done next week.
I understand that. I'm acquiring information. I'm not. We also have, of course, the international visitors who are trapped here.
Yeah, they're a captive market.
But that we won't let them out.
That's right.
I'd be happy to comment on that, though. We're cautiously optimistic. I think we went into COVID in the lockdown period with a great deal of fear and anxiety about the future of Queenstown and Glenorchy, the whole basin. But in the last month, we've been open. We reopened Camp Glenorchy. Mm-hmm. In the last two weekends, we were sold out. Mm-hmm. The domestic market is coming. We're seeing it. People from Auckland, Wellington. Mm-hmm. We're changing our marketing, our messaging, and turning the ship, because 80% of our business at Camp Glenorchy was international. Mm-hmm. Now it's zero. Mm-hmm. In April, our revenues fell by 80% year over year. That was significant. But this month now, we are seeing some positive uptick. So we don't know what the future will portray as far as the short term, but we're cautiously optimistic at the moment.
Which is, of course, Mr. Colgrave's thesis, that there will be some substitution, and we'll look back with the benefit of hindsight, which is always very wise, and know just how well we, or how poorly we survive. But finger in the air, do you think that the 2020 international visit is going to be half? Will it be as much as half?
Well, I mean,
of 2019.
Well, I mean, Auckland Airport's down 97%
at the moment.
Yeah, and so that's been like that for a few months. So it's inevitable that bar's going to look pretty short.
So go on, put your reputation on the line. Is it half or is it up there?
Way less than half.
I'll say half.
Thank you.
And a more important question from my mind is not the 2020 bar.
Yeah,
it's the 2025 bar.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the scary one, because we've just done the best advertising campaign that New Zealand's ever had for a place to be and a place to come. And what's your, if you're giving him a steer on the 2020, give him a steer on the 2025.
the larger ball and then polish it.
Yeah, that's right, polishing. I mean, I think we're actually in a pretty unique position, being one of the only countries to really crush the virus. And while that doesn't give us a lot of benefit in the short term, there's a lot of people that want to come here and live here. A lot of Kiwis want to come home. So, you know, it's going to be stage than the country that beat this thing, and we're clean and green, and you know, I think with some smart marketing we can really pivot from that and do quite well. So, you know, going to be a tough 12 to 18 months, but I think the medium to long term looks really good.
Wicked. Can you write that down and sign it? No, I'm joking.
Any other questions?
Oh. No, that's a good thing.
Mr. Dawson?
No.
I think we're all to Mr. Freeman.
Yes. Thank you. In the context of Glenorchy Township, Whanaumu is a major landowner with interest in visitor accommodation, commercial activities and residential accommodation, and that's accommodation for Whanaumu staff. Whanaumu is also a large employer of people that live in the Glenorchy community. Whanaumu's submission addressed a number of the provisions in the notified settlement zone. The primary focus of the submission was supporting the VA subzone that applied to the settlement zone, extending the VA subzone over the entire site that contains the Mrs. Woolley's general store and temporary camping ground, and imposing the commercial precinct on a portion of this site. The extension of the VA subzone over the full site containing the general store and temporary camping ground will enable Whanaumu to undertake a comprehensive visitor accommodation development in an efficient manner from a consenting perspective, while the controls in the settlement zone will ensure that effects on the surrounding residential amenity will be satisfactorily controlled or mitigated. This land has historically been used for visitor accommodation purposes, and excluding this land from the VA subzone will present a consenting challenge to Whanaumu in terms of the present makeup of the settlement zone. The imposition of the commercial precinct on a portion of the Whanaumu site will allow a reasonable level of commercial activity to operate in conjunction with Whanaumu's existing and proposed visitor accommodation activities. The additional commercial zoning will complement and support the existing commercial activities that are established on and adjacent to Mull Street. The zoning request by Whanaumu and provision amendments, if successful, will enable Whanaumu to develop its land in an efficient manner, which in turn will provide various economic, social and environmental benefits to the local community and visitors to the area. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Talking about your discussion of historic VA accommodation at 10.7 and following of your evidence, Mr. Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
The 10.8 would seem to be an epic fail from a district planning point of view, would seem to indicate an epic fail from a district planning point of view.
Mm-hmm.
What conclusion should we draw as a result? What conclusion should we draw? What should we learn from that?
Well, I think that at the time, if we're referring to the PDP settlement VA subzone basically is copied the ODP, and that goes back to 98. And I have tried to find out what happened in the mid-90s and around that era, but I haven't found any detail as to why the camping ground for the full site was included in the VA subzone. It just seems like they've generally just gone down on the eastern side of Mole Street, looking at the dockland, has followed cadastral boundaries down and just followed a straight line, as opposed to including all of the site in the VA subzone. So I think probably in the context of the PDP, looking at the attributes of the site, but then in the defence of the writers of that zone, when that zone was being written, the back half of the site wasn't being used for accommodation purposes.
Okay, and
and I was just to make sure I'm clear, as I understand it, all of the points have now been agreed between you, Ms. Bowrise and Ms. Devlin.
Yes.
Yes, there's no outstanding issues of contention. That's very good, thank you. That's all for me.
Commissioner McLeod?
That's astounding. That's all for me. Thank you.
thank you. Seems like a good news story. So thank you very much, Mr. Holm, and your team.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Brainard, I say, I hope we have the pleasure of your company for a few months yet. And thank you for attending the hearing.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, sir.
Ready for you, Ms. Robb.
Thank you.
I've not seen it. I'm here on behalf of the VENT submission, but with me today is Mr. Edney, who is the future purchaser of the subject site, and Mr. Espy, who has prepared a summary of... Vivian. Mr. Espy this morning.
Hey, they're very easy to understand.
Vivian and Espy, it's the way it always goes. But not today. Just one today. So I was proposing to start just with a run through of my submissions and any questions you may have for me. I listened to the hearing recording and there were some questions in relation to the settlement and whether it was proceeding with respect to the land of Ms. Nelsop. Mr. Edney can answer any questions in that respect if you have any questions.
So I suppose the question is this now your baby?
Unfortunately, still not. Mr. Vent has a settlement issue, not my issue. He has a settlement issue getting clear title to the land. So we've agreed to keep rolling it over.
So not quite?
Not quite, but I am increasingly keen to become a new owner. And so there has been substantial deposits paid, and I own the stock and assets on there, and we have possession. But to answer you, sir, no, I don't have settlement as of today.
The other question that occurs to me that Mr. Anthony might be able to assist me with, we will hear you separately on the temporary filming provisions on the 30.
Yes, that's right.
Lucky for some.
I don't think it's a Friday.
No, but it's not a Friday. I'm interested in the juxtaposition of the two. The case you're presenting to us essentially to preserve the development rights under the structure plan and to be able to utilise those rights at your option. And the case of temporary filming, because the two do not seem to go arm in arm. If you're going to be you're going to have filming on the approaches to Diamond Lake, it seems difficult to contemplate how you could do that in combination with a reasonably large scale development under the structure plan. So perhaps you could explain that to me.
Would you like to speak, sir?
Yes, I thank you very much. Part of the problem is my vision to see my vision to see the film industry rejuvenated in Queenstown. And it's got actually two components to it. It's obviously making the locations, which Acadia is a significant location, but I also own or control other locations which the film industry want. And also the second thing is to provide a sound stage which is linked to the fibre optic big broadband communication service out in the Gibson. So there is actually two components of that vision to actually rejuvenate the film industry. And we've held a couple of public meetings public being within the film industry, to see whether they are interested in starting up again or whether it's just become too hard. And basically I've been overwhelmed by their desire and demand to actually get it going. So, but Cyril, I could carry on a fraction more. Maybe I should just explain. What has happened is, has come out, and I'm just a sheep farmer, so I don't know anything about this film industry, but what I've become is a two-minute expert, and their demands have been quite interesting because the industry has dramatically changed. And from the good old days of having a 10,000 BC mega production on site, which might lay on site for 2 or 3 weeks, that's at Acadia, it's now starting to come around where series of things, so the Netflix and the Amazons of this world have taken over, and apparently a series of X number of episodes over maybe even 5 years could occur. And of course this is extremely attractive to the local film people because they suddenly see that they need two bases. They need the base I alluded to before, which was the base where they can take their filming, their shots, put it onto the soundstage environment, do the first cut, and then interactively over the fibre optic get involved with the people in Hollywood and in the various places around the world where they have to say that shot is adequate, yes it conveys or not. So that is the soundstage side, but let's talk about, and the reason why you asked me, or I'm answering the question, is how does that affect what's actually happening at, say, a site like Acadia? So instead of having a couple of hundred people up there for a week or two, we've suddenly got to establish a operational base as well as a technical base. So this operational base, and I'll talk a little bit more about, just quickly go across the technical base in the Gibson. That also, the industry here, are starting to say, we need a base in an industrial zone where we can be on the internet or on the fibre so that we can put our containers down. And so between our various filming activities, we can actually have a base there where we all can gather and do things, and the logical place is to have it around the sounds stage, and that made sense to us too. And so that is a subject to a separate proposal. But back on the operational base, so we've got different people now up there. So they want to be able to assemble their sound trucks, all their other paraphernalia to me that they bring for these things. And if they have a large number of staff or even a smaller number of staff, they've got to assemble their staff together, get them there and go up into where the filming location could be. It'll be either on the Paradise paddocks, or it'll be down against the lake. So we'll be using either the rural visitor zone or we'll be using an area up in the prior to the Paradise paddocks where they will get themselves all organised for the shoot, because I did attend one fairly recently where we got reminded that it was something like $38 a minute was being spent, and every minute therefore counts. So they were talking big numbers, and we can obviously get, if you'd like, some more economic information, but it's big numbers. So there's that aspect of being able to use that residential commercial zone as being proposed. Another thing that's just come very clearly is that all of the people who are involved, if they're going to be there for a reasonable length of time, the thought of being able to buy a residential site to be a semi-home whilst they're on site is very, very appealing, particularly with New Zealand at the moment with the pandemic. And not one of them, and that is their potential people who want to create these series, have said, oh no, we can't see ourselves ever wanting to go away from that location. You know, we'd like to have a site up there. So I see part of the thing, the necessity to be able to have, to offer them a residential component.
Ms. Robb, going to your discussion of Section 85, the first question is, is Section 85 an issue for us at all? Do we have any jurisdiction in terms of Section 85, given that it's framed around the Environment Court, an application of the Environment Court either separately or as part of a first schedule process?
The relevance of Section 85 here is that if the rules aren't amended as requested, or if the structure plan is not incorporated into the zone as has been requested, then there is the risk that a Section 85 argument will be taken to the Environment Court.
I suppose my immediate reaction is past experience would be somewhere between 50 and 80% of the people who appear with a reasoned and resourced case in the post-district plan to date and haven't got what they wanted have appealed. Might even be higher than that. I haven't done the numbers. That should we be anticipating what the court might or might not do? Don't we have to just do the best we can and let the chips lie where they may?
I think that it is a relevant consideration in this case in particular because of the unique circumstances. It's when you look at the Section 85 tests in the unique circumstances of this case, that it is a strong ground for appeal in my submission. And I accept what you're saying, but this is a very specific set of circumstances. It's also a snapshot in time with respect to Arcadia. We've got a structure plan that, although council has argued, hasn't been implemented. We don't accept that argument. We think it's clear that it has been implemented and given effect to by virtue of the subdivision consent, and as a result of that, with the proposed rezoning, there is now a loss of those development rights. So specifically what I'm referring to is there is the subdivision consent which granted building platforms, and building on those building platforms would have been a controlled activity consent, and now it is a non-complying consent. I don't think that there's any other circumstance before you with the other requests for rezoning that has the same set of circumstances, and I don't think there's any risk of precedent either, because this is the snapshot in time where Arcadia has landed with the proposed district plan process.
The section, the 42A author's reasoning on section 85 is that it's about depriving of any reasonable use, not the particular reasonable use that the landowner might want to make of the land. What's your response to that?
I have looked at that, and I've looked at the cases and referred to that in my submissions. And in some circumstances, I think it is arguable that it needs to be an all or nothing scenario. And here it is different because we don't fall within that category of all or nothing. It's a situation of a change in activity and whether that gives rise to land being incapable of reasonable use. Again, my argument here is that because the structure plan has been given effect to, and we've got the subdivision consent where titles can issue, at that point in time, the covenant will be registered on the land, which requires compliance with the structure plan. I think that's quite a critical point to understand in terms of this argument of unreasonable use. So we've got 223 survey approval for the titles, and you would have seen the letter provided by Mr. Hewland that says that 224C is achievable within the lapse period. At that point in time, it was anticipated that they'd register the covenant that was required under the structure plan consent, which requires development of the land in accordance with the structure plan. So at that time, when that covenant comes down, we actually fall in a situation where you are required as the landowner to develop in accordance with the covenant, but the zoning provisions don't then enable that development. So we'll be sitting at that point in time in a position when there's an unreasonable use of the land by virtue of the rezoning. And I think that's a distinguishing fact for this case.
Snookered, one might say. Mm.
Yes, by virtue of timing.
A thought occurred to me that the landowner, to use a neutral expression, given we're in this be better off if the land identified for residential use in the structure plan wasn't zoned rural visitor at all and reverted to rural. It wouldn't be non-compliant then. What's your view of that?
That would achieve the outcome of the subdivision, which is currently being consented, but wouldn't address the other areas of rural visitor that are contemplated by the structure plan.
What does the subdivision cover? It's only 12 lots, is it? Yeah, so it's obviously not the whole of the zone, is it? Or
no, it's not all of the zone. It's a pocket of the zone.
If you've got a decent map for the games, we've got some small bits.
I think it was attached to Mr. Vivian's evidence.
So what the?
The subdivision consent plan.
Yes, that won't show it against.
I don't even think my supplies have pulled it off. Plan. Oh, that's the legal submission. So the wrong page.
In terms of the structure plan, can you just tell us which area it's in?
Yes. So if you see the structure plan, the subdivision is in this area up here with my crew.
Up behind the Acadia homestead.
Yes,
that's right.
So can you just point out where the homestead is there? That's in that
the homestead is
bit.
Here.
The purple bit?
Right, that's
yes.
What I assume. Okay.
And there are two red bits to the east, to the west.
That's right.
Is it in the lower red bit?
It is across both of them.
Both those red areas, whatever they are.
It's 1A and 1B?
Yes, res 1A and
res 1B. 1A, 1B, which was identified by Ms. Malsop as lower landscape sensitivity.
Yeah.
And then the other residential areas are effectively over here, which she had identified as moderate to high, which would be discretionary activity.
So there are 12 lots being ready for title to be issued,
yes,
in that 1A and 1B area.
That's right.
And is that what the structure plan would allow for in that area, or is it just part of what it would allow for?
Mr. Vivian can answer that question.
There's 11 lots in that area for residential activity,
yep,
and one lot for a commercial activity.
And that's what?
Which is lot 12.
And that's what's been subdivided. So
yes.
Subdivision sort of mirrors the structure plan in that
yes
area.
Yes, it does. And there's also three balance lots within the subdivision, which are treated as common open space owned. Oh, I can't remember who
yes,
owns
but
them, but it's common open space.
So,
if you do have Mr. Espy's evidence,
yes,
he has attached that consent.
Yeah. Lot 12 doesn't have a building platform.
That's identified for the commercial activity.
Okay.
So,
and that's up on the main road line.
Yes.
And you can see the lots, the residential lots here, and then lot 12, which lines up with the Glenorchy Paradise Road. So you can see that it's
and the common
right up in the corner there.
The common lots are like a park in the middle, and then the road network almost.
Yeah, the purpose of the common lots 101 and 102
yep
were to provide separation to the existing homestead. And we were very careful in making sure that those buildings, those new residential buildings, wouldn't be seen in the context of the homestead. And lot 100, that is a lower area of land with a water race or a stream going through it, so that wasn't suitable for residential development.
So I'm just coming back to your legal submissions about this. When you say that the structure plan's been given effect to, do you say that to the extent of that part of the structure plan, or are you...
My legal submission is the consent that approved the structure plan has been given effect to by virtue of part of it being then further consented.
So
and the reason
on the path,
for,
yeah, and the whole, you know, with the case law that
goes
with
the
that.
Reason for that being that there's numerous cases that
yes.
establish the principle that you don't have
yes.
to have given effect to the
but
whole
yes.
consent. And that was to address the argument that structure plan consent had lapsed,
yes.
which
but
was suggested by council.
But there's a different issue, is what actually has been consented?
The subdivision.
You know. But Ms. Rolston, the consent to grant the structure plan has been activated. But what is that what is a structure plan consent?
It's a guidance under the previous regime as to where development would go.
Seems remarkably like the Auckland outline plans
yeah.
that the Environment Court has
yeah.
said. Effectively,
oh, yeah.
are nothing.
Except for the condition in the structure plan consent that says when you give effect to the structure plan, you register the covenant which requires you to then develop in accordance with that structure plan.
Does it also gives
it the teeth that it didn't have in the rules in the plan?
But like in terms of consents authorise activities that are contrary to Part 3 of the Act, like the provisions in Part 3 of the Act. In this case, it's a land use consent. It's a consent to do something that is, is it a land use or is it a subdivision? Or like
I think everyone accepts it's not a thing that you do nowadays.
No, but the thing is, what I'm getting at, I understand that point, but what I'm getting at is, I understand Ms. Rob's point that or her argument that it's been given effect to because of the extent to which you've gone down the road of getting a subdivision of part of the sub. That's one thing, but in terms of what is this beast that has been given effect to in terms of the RMA world, and has the declaration, or were they declined to give direct declarations in the Auckland outline plan cases? I've forgotten which, but pretty clear that the court said you actually had to be applying for an activity to have anything. Now, clearly the council has purported to grant something, but what is it that it's granted, or is it in fact a nullity? Could you argue that if the structure plan consents a nullity, so is the obligation to register the covenant?
Well, I wouldn't be arguing that it's a nullity because the consent has been granted with conditions, and the condition is to register covenant.
I understand you wouldn't prefer to argue that, you prefer to rely on it, but you would argue it on behalf of the landowner, but is there an argument expressed neutrally that it is a nullity based on the subsequent case law?
Anything's arguable.
Yeah, true.
Can I ask, does the existence of the structure plan consent, whether it, whatever status that has, provide an easier road through the subdivision consent process in terms of the operative plan. I mean, do you need the structure plan to get your subdivision consent?
No, you don't. No.
So why do you need to give effect to this other condition on a different consent, the structure plan consent, at the time of doing the subdivision? What's the relationship between your subdivision consent and the structure plan, or subdivision application and the structure plan consent? None.
No, I don't. There wasn't any provision in the rule to tie the structure plan to anything, which is why they required as a condition of the consent the covenant to be
But
lodged.
You didn't need, I mean, you could have come along with a subdivision that wasn't the same as the structure plan, but similar. Mm. And you weren't required, you know, to get a restricted discretionary or discretionary or whatever it was to be inconsistent with the structure plan.
The status would have been
controlled.
Controlled. Hmm.
It was controlled, the subdivision.
Yes.
Because it was in accordance with the structure plan?
No.
Or just because it was in that zone.
That subdivision pattern could have occurred over the whole site. As a controlled activity.
Yeah, so there's no benefit in terms of this subdivision or any other subdivision for that matter of having the structure plan approval.
Not in terms of future consents.
So I suppose the question that I was heading for was a bit different. When you say that the structure plan consent, if you wish to adhere to it, requires a covenant over the titles, sure, does that just apply to the titles that are part of the subdivision consent?
No, it's to come down on all of the structure plan area.
So the lot 13 or something, which I don't know,
yes.
And 13,
so the covenant
103, these balance areas, whatever
yes.
they are,
the covenant could have been registered at any time
yes.
from when the consent was granted.
Mm.
It could be registered tomorrow.
Yes.
And then it comes down over the
whole
zone.
Of the zone. Yeah.
Which gives rise to the issue going forward.
Yeah, okay. So that was my question. Does it just come down over this corner of it that you've done the subdivision reflecting the structure plan? No, it covers the whole zone, so it affects future, well, in its own way, not a district plan way, but in its own way, it affects future subdivision development on the rest of the zone.
Yes, which brings us back to your question regarding if we just carved out the residential, would that address the issue? No, because we've got the covenant over the whole of the zone, so if you then
it would address some of the issue, but not all, because of the land that hasn't yet been
yes.
the subject of application.
So if you then came along to do a subdivision over on this side of the land, similar to over here, and you'd be required to do it in accordance with the structure plan, but then we run into the issue, which is the issue we have now, if the proposed rules become operative, that the residential activity contemplated would be a non-complying activity.
Probably even the subdivision would be too, actually. And does the subdivision consent have that as a condition, that the covenant come down, or just the structure plan consent?
It's certainly in the structure plan condition. I'd have to refresh my memory. Do you recall off the top of your head?
Part of the subdivision consent approved a variation to the structure plan consent at the same time, and that related to the timing of when the covenant was to be brought down. So the covenant covenant is required under the subdivision consent to be brought down at the time of 224C.
Under the subdivision consent?
Under the subdivision consent.
Yes.
So that's a condition on the more recent subdivision
yes.
consent, br- over from the structure plan and is now in the subdivision consent.
Well, is it in the subdivision consent, or was it in parallel? Is
it a variation?
It's a variation to the previous.
No, that's not the subdivision consent. That's just a variation to the other consent.
Yes.
Just
might have done them in parallel.
It definitely has to be done at 224C, so it's in the subdivision somehow. I'd have to check
I can look at that and respond to
that question.
So the structure plan is not now incorporated into this plan.
Correct.
Right. So I'm just trying to what would be the effect if you withdrew the structure plan consent?
Or surrendered it.
Surrendered it.
I think we would have a trouble exercising the subdivision consent.
Well, the subdivision consent's already been exercised because we've got 223.
Yeah.
I think the answer to the previous question was the subdivision wasn't reliant on the structure thing.
Just have to check that condition.
Well, I'm not sure that was the question, was it?
I did ask. Well, that's what I thought. Was the subdivision consent in any way reliant, or you get an easier ride,
or you
get a different activity status because it reflected the subdivision, the structure plan?
The answer probably turns on the previous question, which was it a 127 variation of the structure plan consent, or was the condition about the timing of the covenant inserted as a condition of the subdivision consent?
No, that's a second question. My question is, what relationship did the subdivision application have to the structure plan in terms of, you know, Mr. Vivian just said it was a controlled activity in the whole zone, irrespective of the structure plan?
Apologies, I was speaking at cross purposes then. I thought your question related to any subdivision on land.
Condition 13 of the subdivision consent, which is prior to certification before pursuant to section 224C, in O, a covenant shall be registered on the lots of 1 to 12, 100 and 101, requiring future development to be undertaken in accordance with the structure plan.
Design
guidelines and the resource consent granted 110010.
That sounds to me
it was only those lots.
It's not the rest of the zone.
But the structure plan consent, it ties together because the structure plan consent, the original consent, required that as a condition of that consent, that when you give effect to that consent, you have to register the covenant over all of the land.
That comes back to the question, can you avoid the issue by surrendering the structure plan consent?
Like you
might have an issue about whether the council would let you, but given the council's created this mess, then they might be receptive to solving it.
But then you can't rely on it.
Yeah.
Then you can't rely
but
on
why
it.
Do you need, what are, what
why
the,
do you
the
need
question
to rely?
That I still haven't had an answer for is what is it that relies on the structure plan?
You can't get 224C.
No,
I understand your question.
In terms of making an application for something.
What benefit do you get in terms of the future consenting pathway from having previously consented the structure plan?
Yes.
Well, there wasn't anything under the old zone, but you had...
But they sort of whipped it in by condition.
You had the activity status, which was already permissive. So it was back to front the way it was done.
Mm.
But what it did mean is when you applied, council referred to this, and with any matters of control or discretion that they had to consider, they already had the structure plan that indicated where the development would be appropriate.
Okay, I mean, yeah.
So another question, so
they essentially gave permissive rules on the basis that they knew people were going to come along with the structure plan and have that assessed as to where it was appropriate to have development.
Yeah. But you could have just applied for a subdivision under those rules as a controlled activity without a structure plan, really, if you read the rules, the letter of the rules.
Yes, yes, you could have.
Yeah.
But
I mean, you didn't, obviously, but I mean,
I think, yes, technically you could have. But I think the whole basis for having this requirement for structure plans was to support the permissive status of activities under the zone.
Yes.
And in this case, they've relied on that process, right or wrong, in terms of how it was put together, and as you've said, wouldn't be done like that now, but they have invested and gone forward on that basis and started this whole process. But partway through the process, now the permissive rules that they're relied on are being taken out.
So I can ask another question. So the overall structure plan, I suppose it's a question to prospective landowner, is that what you're intending to give effect to, the entire structure plan and the further residential subdivision on the other side, because presumably that hasn't got a subdivision consent, and presumably if the consent was surrendered, then that would all fall away.
I would prefer to retain the option because it is understood there's been considerable amount of analysis done on the landscaping and things like that that support that, and the what will happen is at some stage a lodge or something similar could be desired in that area.
I think we've morphed between your legal submissions and Mr. Vivian's evidence.
Yes.
It's sort of casting around to try and understand this.
Well, I mean, that was my main question on the legal submissions, is what is the status of the structure plan and how does that relate to the status of the subdivision that been granted and any future conditions on that subdivision, that extends.
I think that Ms. Rob and Mr. Vivian have given us as much help as they can in a very tangled web. Commissioner Hill,
nothing else on the legal. It was
Commissioner
Third. Just when you summarise it again, the status for when, if another subdivision like this came along, once this one's given effect and that covenant comes down over all of the sites, then the next subdivision
needs to
be in accordance with.
But what Mr.
Vivian
just read out was not the covenant coming down on all of the sites, it was only on lots 1 to 12 and 100.
If you retain the structure plan consent and continue to give effect to it.
Yes. It's been in the first consent that consented the structure plan. It was a condition of that consent to say when you give effect to this consent, and we say giving effect to it is when we do the first subdivision, you must register the covenant over all of the zone.
Yeah.
The second consent that came along, which consented the subdivision, varied that covenant condition in respect of those lots, because those lots tweaked the subdivision plan a bit. There was a further landscape assessment, and they said, move it around a little bit, do some more planting. That wasn't strictly aligned with the original structure plan, so they varied the covenant condition in respect of that subdivision.
Okay.
So then in answer to your question, when the next application comes along under the operative scheme, the covenants will be down on the land, and then that subdivision needs to comply with...
Who's the covenant? Who enforces the covenant? Who's the covenant in favour of? Or?
In this case, it's...
Probably the council.
Council.
Council. So they would have to enforce that through the covenant?
It's a high court action, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it's under the Property Law Act.
Heavens. Oh well.
I think we should move on to see if there are any additional questions for Mr. Vivian on his evidence.
He has prepared a summary.
Have you finished going through your legal submissions?
Well, I was just really taking questions. I haven't gone through all of my...
The Commissioner makes a fair point. Is there anything else you want to add before we pass over to Mr. Vivian? Or have we thrashed around in all directions?
No, I've got lots of questions for Mr. Vivian. You must be kidding.
Have we thrashed around the content of Ms. Rob's
submission? Oh, yes, sure. Sorry, I wasn't listening properly.
I think we've covered off my submission.
That was my only question.
So, Commissioner, since you're threatening Mr. Vivian... Mr. Vivian has a summary. Perhaps you'd better give it to us and we'll go from there.
Okay. Really, my summary just points out the background, refers to Ms. Gross's rebuttal evidence. In paragraph 5, Ms. Gross goes through, if the panel were to come to an alternative view to hers, then she's taken a high-level assessment of the new provisions that I proposed and comments on them as follows. And I've just gone through the ones that I considered were in dispute. And in paragraph 7, I conclude essentially that I think all of those issues in dispute can be resolved. If we had more time, then Ms. Grace and I could sit down, we could possibly resolve a lot of that.
Can I ask just more fundamental before you go to Ms. Dawson?
No, where are you going?
You appeared to us over the last couple of days asking questions about whether the zone is fit for purpose, and in your evidence, you've said maybe the zone isn't, and a specific zone might be more appropriate. Where are you sitting on that? Because, as I said, the rural business zone, as notified, was quite limited, wasn't to include structure plans, wasn't intended to have residential activities, difficult to see. I accept this is remote. Just in thinking about it, it seems I'm not sure this is the right zone, given where you're coming from.
Yeah, I have given some thought to that over the last few days, and I've been trying to think of an alternative zone that could fit this context, and really the district plan doesn't include any alternative zone, apart from the rural zone. There is rural residential zone in the ONL at Camp Hill, which is 2 kilometres away from Arcadia in a straight line. there is a small rural residential zone there that's been there since 1995 at least, which and remains undeveloped as well. But yeah, I've given thought to if this is a resort zone, but the district plan doesn't have any resort zones in the ONL. The rural visitor zone really is the only zone that fits within an ONL.
If you think about the location here at Arcadia, and you've heard us discuss with other people that are coming forward for zones, I mean, this zone was proposed, so there's a bit of a leg up here already.
Yes.
But you've heard us discussing the difficulties of having multiple bespoke zones that start morphing the zone way beyond what is anticipated, was anticipated in the proposed zone. I mean, just going into the RCL and not being remote and having residential. And but this location seems to fit a lot of the bill in a way. It is ONL, it's
yes.
definitely remote. Parts of it are difficult to see, designed to be difficult to see. It's got providing access to people to the landscape and recreation in that landscape that might not be available so readily otherwise. All of those things which is the basis for the zone. if Arcadia didn't have, if there was no history, if the history wasn't there. I'm not trying to dismiss it because I'll come back to that in a minute. I mean, would you think that this is an appropriate location for an RV zone? If there was just a homestead there and a property and someone said, this is a good place for an RV zone. It might have even had one there before, but hadn't got
it. Yes, certainly around the homestead in the area that Ms. Malsop has identified as low, certainly in that area where the subdivision is, I definitely don't have any problem with that. And
even with an area of moderate.
But it's one of the issues that we went through when we developed a structure plan was retaining as much as possible the open space because that's where the value is.
Yeah.
And that is exactly why Mr. Vent wanted to go through that process. He knew that going through that process didn't give him any guarantees that the zone would be retained into the future. But he wanted to go through that process to get a good result and put the covenant in place and then as it develops over time, then it meets his vision essentially. So
I suppose what I'm saying is the thing that distinguishes your position or your client's position on Arcadia from just accepting a normal rural visitor zone, the history.
Yes.
I mean, because otherwise, this meets a lot of the purpose and objectives and policies for an RV zone,
yes.
except the history brings with it lots more residential.
Yes.
Really, isn't it? And over areas that perhaps if we're mapped in accordance with the RV landscape mapping would be in different places.
Yes.
Maybe more the tourism, the visitor accommodation actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. The other thing that perturbs me, I suppose, is that in the meantime, between when the PDP, the ODP was set up and the structure plan idea was in the permissive zone was put in place, there have been a lot of changes to the landscape, higher order provisions.
Yes.
There's been the OR, the RPS, and then the Chapter 3 and Chapter 6 have come along. So at what point, when you're getting this much more forceful focus, I suppose, on outstanding natural landscapes, at what point do you pull back from archaic plan provisions?
I guess the real difficulty with that question is the fact that the review has been staged. And my understanding has always been that under, and I think I explained this in my evidence, under stage one of the plan, the planning map showed Arcadia as being rural visitor zone. There were no provisions associated with it, but the planning map showed that. Then Mr. Vent did a submission in support of that. They found the submission, I think the submission was later withdrawn because the hearings committee wouldn't consider it. And then they withdrew the zoning, and stage one of the plan just showed a blank site. So my understanding was that with that blank site went the O&R status over this proposed zone. It's still within an O&R,
yeah,
but the actual site itself wasn't classified under the stage one of the PDP as an O&R, and it's still a bit unclear in my head as to whether
even if this zone wasn't in an O&L, it's still within an O&L.
Yeah, yes.
And so,
yeah,
in terms of the growing policies like the RPS and
how this zoned land or the zone, the future zone, relates to the Chapter 3 objectives and policies, it
wasn't clear at that time.
It wasn't clear at all.
So does that come back? So say, I mean, if Mr. Vent had never given effect to this, his whatever might have been allowed in the old RV zone, hadn't gone through the structure plan, hadn't started developing, the zone had just sat there for 20 years,
yep,
would your argument be different now in terms of under the newer RPS, the Chapter 3, Chapter 6, the sort of planning framework we have now? Would you be anticipating a zone that allows for as much as your client's trying to achieve now?
I think it would be a far more difficult argument.
Yes.
Because at some point
you have to give effect to those other provisions.
Yeah. Probably not so much the structure plan argument, but certainly the residential subdivision, which is live, can be exercised, has conditions which clearly anticipate residential activity.
Because he's taken it that far. So that's where you come back to what Ms. Rob's been saying. It's about a point in time. And the point in time can relate to the fact that we have had the staging as well as the point in time relating to where he's got to with giving effect to what was a zoning that has been there since 95 or something.
Yes.
And the point that I, when I addressed that question in my submissions also was that there was a point in time when it was specifically assessed, all of those O&L considerations, which was the structure plan. So the land, even though there are the more restrictive provisions that you've referred to that have come into effect, the point I was trying to make in my legal submissions is that there was still a very robust assessment taking into consideration protection of the O&L when the structure plan was approved.
as those provisions were at that time.
But in my submission, it actually went further than that, and I set out in my submissions that Ms. Malsoff has said in her evidence, I just undertook a first principled approach because of the RVZ regime at the time, effectively saying that I didn't give it such a robust assessment as I would now.
Yeah.
But I don't think when you read her reports that that was in fact the case, and I have included in my submission some excerpts from those reports and yeah. also the urban design panel's comments where they, so my submission was all the consultants did acknowledge that this was a very unique and beautiful site that needed to be protected, and they took that into account when they assessed this proposal. At paragraph 29 of my submissions, I included the excerpt from Ms. Malsop when she said, the classification of the landscape surrounding and including the site is not required for assessment of a controlled activity application. However, in this particular situation, it is relevant to consider the landscape in the context of the site. And then she goes on to say, there's, in my opinion, the significant aesthetic and natural values of the area mean it's appropriately classified as an outstanding landscape. Then she goes on to do quite a specific assessment against the objectives and policies and assessment criteria at the time, and by virtue of the fact that then she recommended changes, I think she did go a lot further and did carry out a very robust assessment, further than what was required by the RVZ. And even the urban design panel in their comments, they said, and this is the context I think everybody was considering this structure plan in, they said the site embodies all of the characteristics that one associates with the adjective iconic, surrounded by towering mountains, flanked by forested hillsides and fronting the lake. One would be hard-pressed to find another site within the district that combines such splendid, pristine isolation with unconstrained development rights. And they identified as an issue how to introduce development without compromising the outstanding visual amenity and sense of raw isolation of the site and its setting. So that was the basis for my submission. Everybody was working extremely hard with this structure plan to ensure that it did protect that unique setting.
And I understand that the operative district plan, I mean, it wasn't silent on outstanding natural landscapes or whatever. Those aspects were well and truly included in the operative plan. They may be different now and maybe more advanced or whatever, more refined, but it wasn't silent on it.
No, and Ms. Malsop referred to that. She went through the objectives and policies and acknowledged that she wasn't actually required to do that, but did carry out that assessment, which then informed the next iteration that went before council. And it was really only one issue that she still raised, which was a setback from the lake front. That was the only outstanding issue, and they relied on the other landscape assessment by Mr. Baxter. And then following that whole process, they underwent another landscape assessment with Dr. Marion Reid when they did the RM13 consent.
So, Mr. SBD. Sorry, Mr. Levine.
Sorry, that's my fault.
I
took us
down
that track
now. How do we come to the conclusion that what you're recommending be included in the RV gives effect to the RPS and implements the Chapter 6, Chapter 3 and Chapter 6 in terms of outstanding natural landscape? Or will the exclusion zone deal with that?
Yes.
Or are you going to rely on the exclusion zone dealing with that?
I think I should rely on the exclusion zone for...
But we don't have that yet. And even if we do, it may well say that the provisions of the zone need to stand in lieu of
or achieve the same result as
as if it was in a rural zone. I mean, do you accept that's a difficult point?
It is an extremely difficult point.
That it achieves the objectives.
Yeah.
For chapter 3 and however chapter 6 is the
end of that. Yeah.
Mm.
But that really goes back to the point about the fact that it has been assessed.
Assessed, yes. Yeah.
Previously, and I don't know, even though they are more robust, well, I think they are more refined than...
Miss Millsop's evidence to us is definitely this would not give effect, this would not implement those chapters.
Which we take issue with.
Absolutely, we understand that. Fully understand that you take issue with that, but that is her evidence. That to do that now, to do this, or to allow this zoning with this level of development now, would not achieve the outcomes sought through those chapters or the RPS.
Well, essentially, that boils down to protecting the O&L, as I understand it, all of those provisions. It's more... explicit in protecting the O&L, and
even in one of these zones as well.
Yes, and we're saying we're confident on the assessment that was previously provided by a number of landscape architects that it does protect the values of the O&L.
And you have chosen not to bring a landscape architect to tell us about that under the current scheme of things.
Yes, we're relying on the previous assessments.
Calling a spade a spade, you're saying Ms. Millsop's being inconsistent.
Yes, I'm saying I don't think that there is significant change in the provisions now compared to then to warrant a complete change, well, a significant change in her assessment of how this affects the values of the O&L.
Your planner doesn't this demonstrate that particularly in terms of the change of provisions from one to the other. You don't have evidence about that.
You do rely on the previous assessments, though.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so you consider the objectives and policies and then rely on the previous assessments. But I'll let you speak to that.
In my evidence, I do go through the chapter 3 and 6.
Yes, you do. I fully accept that.
I don't have anything further, I think, if they've been all covered.
I acknowledge this is above my pay grade.
Likewise, it's a tangled web. We all know that. I don't think, certainly on this side of the table, I'm sure that we haven't formed a view, but we understand the problems. We just haven't quite figured out the solutions. But thank you very much for your input, and as I say, I think this will keep us grinding away for a while. Ms. Robb, you're down, lucky last, sustainable, or is it you?
The
people sitting patiently behind you. So I invite you to exit stage left.
Thank you very much.
See you,
Monica. Yes, we'll be back.
Like the Terminator.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
the afternoon's worn on and probably hasn't improved you listening to that debate over very tangled planning provisions.
May I say how impressed I am with your resilience in being able to handle all this detail and still look lively and attentive at this time of the day.
Probably not seeing it as our best.
I think otherwise.
We'll perk up.
I'm Bruce Farmer. I'm Chair of Sustainable Glenorchy, and I've been a Glenorchy ratepayer for almost 50 years. Sustainable Glenorchy is an incorporated society and follows the resource management definitions for sustainability and for our futures. And we're also guided by the Glenorchy Head of the Lake Community Plan. And just at this point, I found it very difficult to get over all the submissions and all the detail that you have to be over all of it. And but we're grateful to the QLDC planners who are looking at the submissions and trying to make them consistent with the community plan. And so therefore I thought I'd just sort of step back, if I may, and just look at the key elements of the community plan and how it may be given better effect. The Glenorchy Head of the Lake Community Plan was formulated in 2001 and it was reviewed again and affirmed by a Shaping the Future exercise in 2015.
Do we got a copy of that the other day, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And it's
the
also
council provided it to us.
Okay, and it's on the website, both documents. One follows the other. At that time, Glenorchy Head of the Lake talked about the spirit of Glenorchy as a vibrant community where the lifestyle and freedom are highly valued together with the peaceful, unspoiled rural environment and the dynamic interaction with the spectacular landscape, heritage, and wilderness. And then they said they saw their values as being safe, caring, self-reliant, working together, welcoming visitors, and having residents who respect the environment. Glenorchy is unique. I suppose every community thinks it is, but Glenorchy has some real differences, and that is that it has the magnificent natural landscape. There has been no road there to the rest of New Zealand until 1962, so it was relatively isolated. And its population is self-selected. The people live there because they love the outstanding beauty, the views of the mountains, the lake, and the rivers, and the easy access to wilderness. The population is diverse, independent, and has respect for each other in the Glenorchy and the environment, and each other's values. Unfortunately, this is changing with the modern world, and a developer has been changing those and arguably not respecting the values and caring for the community. It has publicly notified a 10-metre high building in a 5.5 visitor accommodation zone, and unusually for a small town, there have been 83 community submissions on it, and over 80% of them were opposed to it.
So was that, just to clarify, was that 8 or 83 submissions?
83.
Thank you, sir.
83, and over 80% opposed. This can easily be handled with simply working with the community, respecting its values, and in particular, the community plan. The community plan states that developments need to be consistent with the rural character of Glenorchy in building style and landscape treatment. buildings to be have mostly buildings have been built to within the regulated height of a zone, and that's been applied almost universally, accepted by all out of respect for their neighbours. Should you consider, the commissioners, consider changing these standards, particularly on height, on the in the commercial and the visitor zones, and allowing this change to go ahead, we would respectfully ask that you consider that this be considered as a major change to the PDP. And as such, we respectfully request that it be treated as such, as a significant change, and be notified so the views of the community can be considered. As an alternative for that, perhaps the community could be consulted on a new master plan for the Glenorchy Township.
Mr. Powell, can you clarify, please? I say we're all friends here. Yeah. Call a spade a spade. What, who's the developer and where's the property?
The developer is Blackthorn Developers. The submissions, the submission largely gives license, or is asking for license to do almost anything they want. They are developing. They have a publicly notified development on a hotel on the right in the area that's been now
One Benmore Place.
One Benmore Place,
yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And then also several other sections which are being asked on Alfred's Terrace, which is a new development on the going into town, and where it seems that it may be changing, but many of the, there's development going ahead on three of those sections which were just normally residential as visitor accommodation, and it's now being requested to come into visitor accommodation to be extended to that.
So I read your submission the other night, and so what as I understand it, you're saying that the process that the community's gone through to develop and then review the community plan, and the fact that that's reflected in some of the standards and rules in the district plan, like the 5.5 metre height,
yes,
are very important to the community.
Absolutely.
And what you're asking for is not us not to introduce more non-notification provisions.
Yes.
To make sure that if there are breaches of these sorts of standards, they remain the ability for them to be notified and the community to be involved.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner.
Coming from your involvement right from the start of the community plan, you don't want to then be excluded when it comes to breaches of those provisions. Yeah. No, it's very good. Thank you. And you've given a really good background.
Sensational.
Thank you.
Thank you for good working with Glenorchy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming down to see us. We appreciate you taking that time. And
thank you. We appreciate being heard, sir. Thank you.
Safe driving home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll stand adjourned until this coming Tuesday, which is 4th of August at 9 a.m.